beyond the human humanoid, so to speak. I want to just say, like, there's no way that we can use the what we call normal or standard scientific methods with this, because you can't put a UFO in a laboratory and do double blind research. So here we are. Can you say anything about the perceptual limitations we have in looking at all of this?
Yeah, this is an important point that I'm really struggling with myself. So earlier I mentioned this notion of shape shifting, that the beings have an ability to appear different ways. They just know how to manipulate reality in ways that we can't understand. But they also seem to be able to alter human memory. And the phenomenon is typically described as a screen memory, where there's one researcher, his name is Mike Cleland, who focuses in particular on owls, because this comes up often with UFO encounters or alien encounters, where a person will say, "I encountered an owl on the side of the road and I checked out the owl, and all of a sudden a few hours were missing. What happened?" And this is a typical phenomenon known as missing time. So somehow the memory's wiped, but then the person might have the memories come back and they'll see something different. So for example, they might use hypnosis to try to unlock the memory, and the hypnotherapist will ask the person to try to go over to the owl in the person's mind and say, "Well, could you describe the owl?" And then when they go to the owl in their mind, they'll say, "Wait a second, this isn't an owl, this is a gray alien." A screen memory. So what profound implications here? Because I'm now wondering basically everything in my memory. How do I know for sure that it is what I remember it to be? How do we know that memories are not implanted or thoughts are not implanted? Because our brain seems to be picking up signals from all over the place. I don't know. It's very confusing.
Yes, it is very confusing. I'm so glad that you mentioned the work of, let's see, Abbott. I can't remember his first name, but he wrote a book, Flatland. And
Yes.
it was such a good way of describing how we perceive as human beings with our senses, the way we see things with our eyes or our ears or how we touch things or smell or taste. But there's so much more to perception. And Flatland really kind of gives us a good analogy for that. Can you describe Flatland and what that's like?
Yes, I'm really glad you brought that up because that's helped me try to think about this. Flatland is the idea that human beings are living in a two-dimensional world, almost like a flat piece of paper. So if you take that analogy and imagine that a sphere, so a three-dimensional object, intersects with Flatland, the intersection is a circle in Flatland. So the people, imagine if you lived in that two-dimensional Flatland and the sphere intersects. People in Flatland would see a circle and they'd all point to the circle and they would try to analyze what the circle is. And let's say they got everything right about the circle, they would still be missing a lot of the sphere because they're only perceiving at a two-dimensional level, whereas the sphere is three dimensions. And what if we're dealing with something that is multi-dimensional? What if it's not just 2D versus 3D? What if it's something that we can't even comprehend? It's almost to me like the notion of infinity, which we acknowledge as a reality, but it is incomprehensible to the human mind.
And even Einstein talked about the idea of more dimensions exist than what we perceive as three-dimensional.
Absolutely. I mean, our eyes are extremely limited. Even from a conventional perspective, we know that there is an electromagnetic spectrum of all sorts of types of light that our eyes don't ordinarily see. So we have a limitation in this human body as to what we can perceive, and yet we're trying to understand things that are probably multidimensional. And that's why this seems to be such a challenging phenomenon. I mean, I've read lots of researchers, and it doesn't seem like anyone has a full grasp on it because we're all humans. And we might be getting little pieces of the sphere, but we're not getting the whole thing.
Well, this is kind of where psychedelics come in a way. As you said earlier on in our conversation, that when you're in a near-death experience or psychedelics, the brain actually turns off its filter. It kind of describe what happens to our brain and our physiology with psychedelics, and how we can then contact maybe other realities.
Well, the conventional view of the brain and consciousness, and I wrote about this in my first book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, is that the brain produces consciousness. And when the brain shuts off, there is no consciousness. There's no life after death. And in order to have a very complex experience under this perspective, you'd probably expect a lot of brain activity. And in fact, the reverse seems to be true in some cases. So psychedelics is one example, but in a very extreme case is a near-death experience where a person has little or no brain functioning. And yet when they're resuscitated, they come back and say, that was realer than real. It's the inverse of what you'd expect. So there are a number of phenomena like this. Savants is another example. People who have brain damage in some ways, but they have extraordinary mathematical abilities or musical abilities. So it's almost like when the brain shuts down, consciousness is expanded. And this might be what's happening in psychedelics with emerging research. Still, this is ongoing, but there seems to be research suggesting that reductions in brain functioning associated with the psychedelic trip are correlated with an enriched consciousness when people say, wow, I was in this other dimension. So it's like you get rid of the filter. If the brain is a filter for consciousness, when you get rid of that filter, wow, these expanded dimensions of reality open up, which is, as you point out, might be able to tell us something about the nature of reality by examining some of these experiences. So in the book in particular, I focused on the research on DMT, which stands for dimethyltryptamine. This is a significant molecule. Some call it the spirit molecule because of what it seems to do to people. They are opened up to these other realities, and it is produced in nature and actually produced in the human body. But typically, it's decomposed so quickly that we're not all in those other dimensions all the time. But for example, with the substance ayahuasca, the combination of chemicals basically in the plants allows the DMT to exist in the body for longer, like for hours. So people end up in these altered states. But also Rick Strassman from the University of New Mexico ran studies where he was intravenously injecting people with DMT just to examine basic things like their physiology, their blood pressure, things like that. And what he found was that people were encountering non-human intelligences, which was not, from an ethical perspective, he wasn't expecting to subject people to this, and he ended up shutting down the study. But very interestingly to me, this shocked me when I was researching this, people were reporting the same things that are reported in alien abductions. Now, Dr. Strassman did not know about alien abductions when he ran the study. Many of his volunteers who were taking DMT were not familiar with alien abductions, and they were reporting sometimes being operated on, encountering similar types of species. So interestingly, John Mack endorsed Rick Strassman's book on DMT because for obvious reasons, he was interested too.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. And I know I remember doing an interview with someone who was talking about near-death experience. And in that experience, this person visited, he was dead on the table, no brain function. And he experienced visiting his family in India, half a planet away. And when he came back into himself, he was able to describe exactly what his mother was wearing at the time and describe what she was doing at the time that he was visiting, and all of this really correlated. So it just tells us, boy, there's more going on here than what meets the eye, literally.
Yes. And what you described is known as a veridical out-of-body experience. They're the most powerful pieces of evidence, I think, which suggests that near-death experiences, or at least some of them, are not hallucinations. Because if a person comes back with a memory that can be validated and verified by someone who was not sick at the time, that suggests by definition that it's not a hallucination. And these are sometimes reported in the hospital room where the person's operated on. They hover over their body. They see things from that vantage point, from outside their body. How could that be? I mean, even if they were not unconscious at the time, how could you see something from the ceiling or see something in another room? So all of these things seem to suggest that the brain or the physical body actually restrict our consciousness. And there are things that can be done to expand our awareness outside of this flat land, so to speak, where we can perceive at a different dimensional level. And when that happens, it seems that our reality is much more complex than we're taught it is.
Right, exactly. And in going back to verified phenomenon, I'd like to talk about, let's go back to UFOs for a second here. And there were a couple that I would love for you to talk about, because there were two that really popped for me. One was the Phoenix Lights, and the other was the United Airline employees in Chicago. So if you could describe those two in particular as an example of many people seeing the same thing.
Sure. So in the book, what I try to do is to go through many of these cases, because if it's just one case, it's harder to verify. And what I found to be compelling is that there are many cases where multiple people seem to be able to verify this stuff. And that's powerful to me. So the Phoenix Lights example is a famous one from 1997, where there were basically boomerang formations of lights in Nevada. They moved down into Arizona, and people were seeing a craft hovering for about 5 minutes, and they could see the bottom of the object. And then later in the night, it was just motionless in the sky, and lots of people saw it. So there's even a book called The Phoenix Lights by Lynn Kitay, and there's a documentary on this one. And there was a press conference held by the then governor of Arizona, who was trying to reduce the public panic, and they tried to make it seem like a joke. But allegedly later he stated, well, I'm a pilot, and I know the machines that fly in the sky, and this was bigger than anything that I've seen. So that was a pretty powerful one. And then the other one you mentioned, the United Airlines case, this was from November of 2006. And one of the best researchers, if your listeners are interested in this, is Richard Dolan. He's done some incredible research documenting case after case, UFOs and the national security state. I believe they're two volumes, and they're like history books. It's pretty amazing. But this case here was one that Dolan described. He talks about a dozen employees roughly from United Airlines who saw this disc or oval-like thing hovering in the sky, and it was visible for about 15 minutes. I mean, it's pretty interesting to me when you have people who are used to looking at the sky, and they're up in the sky very often. What were they looking at there? And apparently the employees were told not to discuss the matter, the United employees, which is another theme in the research, which is that there's often a lot of suppression.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm here with Mark Gober, and he is the author of An End to Upside Down Contact: UFOs, Aliens, and Spirits, and Why Their Ongoing Interactions with Human Civilization Matters. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, markgober.com, and he spells his last name G-O-B-E-R, markgober.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Mark Gober, and we're talking about intelligences beyond the human intelligence that may be contacting us on this planet. And so is there any evidence of a galactic federation?
Well, It was reported in December of 2020, the former Israeli head of space directorate. This was reported in NBC News. He talked about the existence of a galactic federation. And he said, this was his claim, is that they've been waiting until today for humanity to develop to the point where we would basically understand this sort of thing. But he's not the only person. I mentioned that because this was a mainstream. You could just look up the news article in NBC News that this is a pretty high level person talking about it. But in the book, I also talk about remote viewers. And so remote viewing is the ability to perceive something with the mind alone. So meaning like psychic perception. And the U.S. government ran a psychic spying program, which I've written about in my previous books. It's been declassified. They say in their own documents, remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. So if we accept that's possible, that you could perceive something that's far away in space and time, then theoretically, you might be able to look at things even on other planets. And there's an organization called the Farsight Institute, run by Dr. Courtney Brown from Emory University, who runs experiments on this, where he has multiple remote viewers try to look at historical events or even sometimes current events just to see what they come up with and see if he can triangulate different things. And what he claims is that the Galactic Federation comes up in a lot of their readings, and also the notion of the interaction of non-human intelligences with human civilization. That came up for them a lot. And it wasn't something they were even looking for initially, which I find interesting. They were just looking at archaeological sites, for example, and then they kept doing it. And the psychics were seeing aliens popping up, and the aliens were intervening with human society, which is pretty crazy. But with regard to the Galactic Federation, he says that it seems to be benevolent. That's what these remote viewers say. But their intervention in our society is limited because there's something about allowing humans to learn and allowing humans to make their own choices. So they might want to steer us in a positive direction, but it's not like they're just going to take over and fully change the direction of what happens here. It has to be voluntary.
So this is like real Star Trek sort of, you know, I'm a real Trekkie fan, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it sounds like. And even in the book, I mentioned a study. It's called the Free Study, F-R-E-E, run by Ray Hernandez and someone from the Harvard Smithsonian Institute. So some very credible people. And they examined over 3,000 people who claimed to have UFO-type encounters or encounters with other intelligences. And many of them talked about having knowledge of an ET council and being brought into an ET council meeting. So this is something that seems to come up very frequently from different areas.
There were also some very disturbing research that you've done and that was very hard to read about. And this is where truly, truly evil and dark sorts of, I don't know if they're abductions, but they're rituals that happen. Do you recall what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, this is an unpleasant topic, and it's not something that I enjoy writing about. But what I found in my own spiritual journey is that the ultimate nature of reality seems to be benevolent. That there's this sun that's always shining the rays of unconditional love. That's what people are reporting. But we live in a realm that is not fully that. So it's like there's this paradox of there's pure benevolence on the one side, but then there's this duality of light dark within the realm that we live in. And the dark seems to be multidimensional. So it's not just humans who might be psychopathic and not have any empathy. There are beings who enjoy that sort of thing as well. And in the same way that a channeler, for example, might want to invoke a benevolent entity and have that entity bring information, there appear to be people that do the inverse. So they try to invoke a dark being. And the way that happens is through some horrific rituals, usually involving bringing about fear and suffering in really horrific ways. But for whatever reason, that seems to attract these dark energies on a metaphysical level, almost like they feed off of the energy. And I think it's important to acknowledge that these things exist, not necessarily to get just wrapped up in the darkness of it, but to acknowledge that it's a reality. Because without realizing how dark things can get, I think it can blind one to the truth of possibilities. So that's the reason I wanted to include it in the book, and also to show that there is this wide spectrum that we see. Like in a near-death experience, people talk about really angelic type beings who they feel just nothing but unconditional love. And then we see the exact opposite, where there are beings who like very negative things.
Right. Well, I'm reminded, and this is where I connect interviews from very different people. So I'm going to connect what you're saying with something that I just finished an interview with Barbara Hort. She was talking about pandemics, and so a very different subject. But one of the things that came up, because as she was talking about it, she's talking about mythology that goes through time and has been part of our heritage as human beings. And there is the Greek myth of Persephone being abducted by Hades and taken to the underworld. And I just feel like it relates a bit to what you're saying here and reporting about this darkness. And what I learned about Persephone is that she is the one deity who made the conscious decision to eat the pomegranate seeds so that she would always go back down to the underworld. She became the queen of the underworld. And in that way, she stayed in contact with the gifts that the underworld had to give. So I'm kind of bringing that in to relate to when evil exists, or that which is not light, whatever that is. I'm not sure what evil is, but not light, we'll say. There are gifts. I mean, Carl Jung talked about it in Dark Night of the Soul, and Shakespeare talks about it. I mean, going down, and there are gifts. So this is what we as conscious beings need to cultivate, is the gifts of the darkness.
Right. And in some cases, it can be something that allures people, where it's sort of like, we'll give you these gifts if you sell your soul. And it can be used for the purposes of power. So you're reminding me of a story that has stuck with me from Dr. David Hawkins, who on his own path to enlightenment, if we want to call it that, where he was elevating and letting go of his attachments, he got to a point where it was just him. He felt like he was by himself in a very transcendent state. And then essentially a being appeared. He called it a knowingness, but it was this energy that said in an instant, you have transcended all of your personal karma. All power is yours. Just take it. You can have power over others. And he thought for a second, well, wait a second. If I am everything, why would I need power over others? I reject this. And what he said is, after he rejected it, he entered a new state of consciousness above where he was. So some amazing state. But he was also shown some of the beings who were faced with a similar temptation in the past, but they took the temptation. And he said they had a great karmic fall where they had to start from a much lower level, whereas others who didn't take the temptation got to advance. So to me, there always seems to be this choice that we're tempted. And maybe this is part of our evolution. Maybe that's what evil is that it's testing us constantly. And we get to make the choice. Are we going to take it and use it for something good, or is it going to pull us in a negative direction?
And isn't that the whole Jesus story when he's tempted by the devil? I mean, or they call it the devil. I'm not sure that that's the entity that comes to him when he's out in the desert.
Yes, Hawkins refers to that. He says that Jesus, also the Buddha, was beset by demons. So this seems to be a common part of our path individually and collectively.
So that's hopeful then, and a reason to continue on our path towards transcendence. Or I don't want to go up, you know. I mean, up is not, Bucky always talked about it, there is no up in the universe. It's only inside or outside. So really being conscious that we do have the choice, and to make choices toward goodness rather than the opposite.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about that, but that's Mark, there's so much we could talk about here. And we've covered a lot of ground. And if there's just anything that you want to add at this point, I mean, I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but anything that you might want to add in this closing minute that we have together today.
Sure. Well, I'll refer quickly to the Nag Hammadi scriptures, which have captured my attention. These were discovered in 1945 in Egypt. They are written about 2,000 years ago bound books that were apparently heretical. So the church didn't want them for whatever reason, which to me indicates we should pay attention to them. But they talk about origin stories. There are many books. And one of the origin stories, or multiple of them, talk about the notion that there are non-human intelligences that essentially keep humanity in a state of ignorance. And there's a quote that I return to all the time, and I'll paraphrase it here, in one of the Nag Hammadi scriptures called The Nature of the Rulers. And it says, "The rulers kept humanity in a state of confusion and a life of toil so that they would be preoccupied with the things of the world and not have time to be occupied with the Holy Spirit." And that to me resonates because it's very much the world that we live in, that there are many distractions, and it's our path perhaps to transcend or to go outside of that. But it also introduces the idea that there are these forces that seem to want to suppress humanity, and it brings to light the perennial notion of a kind of a spiritual war that might be existing.
So may we all become spiritual warriors for the good. Thank you so much, Mark, for being with us today. I want to remind our listeners, if you want to know more about his work, his website is markgober.com. And he spells his last name G-O-B-E-R, markgober.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3779.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm John Gray.
And I'm Arjuna Arda. We are the authors of Conscious Men.
Next time on New Dimensions, we'll be talking about understanding men and women and their new challenges in relationships.
Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine
equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You're tuned into